welcome. As always, even though that music is from Two Guys Gaming, this is One Guy Reading. Whether you meant to or not, you found Noobs Book Club. I'm Sean, noob of all trades from Two Generations Gaming, and in this series I am reading and reacting to The Poppywar, the novel by R.F. Kuang. I think it's been about 2 weeks since the last time that I released an episode for the series, and I had hoped to have this wrapped up by now so that I could do the next Dragonlance book, but as you know, things happen. One of the things that happened is that we went on vacation to the Cape, and I was able to write my notes for the last three episodes for this series, so I will have this wrapped up by the end of this week, and then next week we can go on to the next book in the Dragonlance series. I received the book in the mail, and I'm pretty excited to get that one started because it wraps up the trilogy for the Dragonlance. What are they calling it? Destinies? Something like that. I don't know. But we will get to that starting next week. And I will do that one for the end of August and September. And then in October, I'm going to do Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And then after that, well, you can look at the schedule. I updated it in the show notes. In this episode, episode 4, I'm going to cover chapters 9 through 16. Something like that. I don't know. I'll have to take a look. I don't remember which chapters I did last time. I know I'm going to do at least 10 through 16, and then I had done the other two, but I think I have to do 9 as well. I'll figure it out. And you'll find out as well in a minute once I get over to Super Summary and start the summary. Thanks to Super Summary for providing the summary. You can check it out. You need a subscription in order to get the full summary for this book. That's not me suggesting that. That's me simply saying that's the truth of the matter. And now to give you the summary from supersummary.com. This is for chapters 10 through 16. Part 2, Chapter 10. The beginning of this chapter is told from the point of view of the Tsika commander Tyr on board the Federation-owned schooner, the Emperor Riohai. On Daji's orders, Tyr lurks on the ship cloaked in shadow. He finds it difficult to leave the darkness and thinks about Chulu Korik, the stone mountain where shamans are imprisoned when they lose their sanity. Daji comes aboard and meets with Federation General. She spots Tyr and pushes him off the ship, killing him. In midsummer, the Federation declares war on Nakan and begins decimating northern cities, conquering Horse Province on their way to Sinigard. The academy is transformed into a military encampment. Classes stop meeting, and the instructors resume the positions they had in the Second Poppy War. Rin wants to call the gods to help them fight, but Jiang warns Rin that shamanism shouldn't be militarized. He grows agitated when Rin mentions the phoenix and begins to avoid her again. She sneaks into his garden and steals poppy seeds. Part 2, Chapter 11. The Federation breaches Sinigard's walls. Rin makes her first kill. She feels no emotion. She is tempted by the phoenix's fury and the poppy seeds in her pocket, but decides against calling the god. Rin is attacked while staring at Robin's dead body, but Nisha saves her. The former enemies team up and effectively cover each other's weaknesses. The Federation General approaches them, but Jiang blocks him. The general recognizes Jiang, who is radiating with quiet power. A gate appears behind Jiang, and beastly cries come from within. Jiang tells Rin and Nisha to run, but a wall comes down around them. Rin wakes under the rubble with Nisha beside her, bleeding profusely. She watches frozen as the Federation General climbs out from beneath the rubble and stabs Nisha in the stomach. Rin swallows the poppy seeds and begs the phoenix for help. She becomes an unmediated conduit for the phoenix, who burns the general and everything in the vicinity. Rin loses all sense of time. She hears Niang taking care of her, and she is visited by Daji, who kisses Rin's forehead and cools her internal fire. Part 2, Chapter 12. Rin is held in the basement. She learns from Kate that the Federation retreated in fear of the Spearly. Rin is shocked to realize he means her. The academy is liquidated, Jiang is missing, Nisha is in the critical care unit, and the students are dispersed among various divisions. Kate leaves with the 2nd Division to the wartime capital, Golanese. Irja, now a general, visits Rin on her 6th day in captivity. He reveals that he raised Altan after the Second Poppy War, and that he knows about Spearly's powers. Rin is distressed when Irja tells her that she's being assigned to the Tsika. Rin, remembering the Tsika's terrible reputation, is distraught, but Irja says he recommended Rin to the Tsika to save her from being a pawn in the warlord's disputes. He calls in the Sika commander, who turns out to be Altan. Altan is astounded that another Spearly lives. He promises to help Rin control her power. Altan tells her that everyone in the Sika, except the munitions expert and their physician, are shamans. Rin and Altan journey to the port city Kertalane. Altan reveals that the country hinges on Kertalane's fate. Part 2, Chapter 13. 3 weeks later, Rin and Altan arrive at Kertalane. They meet Kara, one of the Sika, who tells them that the Federation captured three sides of the city and a stretch of beach. Kara says the warlord's fighting has been exacerbated by a new general, who turns out to be Jin. Jin appears, dragging a teenage Sika member, Ramsa, by the ear. Jin mocks and threatens the Sika, infuriating Altan. Altan and Ramsa go to the government complex to meet with the warlords, while Kara takes Rin to Enki, the Sika physician, who carefully meets her out some psychedelics. At mealtime, Rin is introduced to more Sika members. Baji, a strong man who channels a boar spirit, Aracha, a river god initiate who spends his time as a barrel of water, and Yanagin, a shapeshifter. Another Sika member, Suni, aggressively enters the mess hall. He is being mentally tormented by his deity, the monkey god. Altan rests his forehead against Suni's and soothes him until the god exits his mind. Part 2, Chapter 14. After 3 days of meeting with the warlords, Altan summons Rin. He tells her about how commanding the Sika is different than dealing with the Synegardian graduates. They are undisciplined but have immense power when put to the right use. The rest of the Sika arrive, and Altan details a plan to sink a fleet of Federation ships. 3 days later, the Sika get in position. The boats approach, and Ramsa forces them towards the Sika. Aracha manipulates the tides to ground the fleet. Kara assassinates Federation soldiers with arrows, while Suni and Baji smash through the rest. Rin and Altan are meant to take care of the stragglers, but Rin cannot call the Phoenix. Altan pushes her to safety and conjures a pair of fiery wings that incinerate everything in the vicinity. Together, the Sika sink the entire fleet. Altan leaves to brief the warlords, and the others begin talking about the fall of Spear. Kara says the Spearly Queen, Myrinin Tirza, could have called the Phoenix to save the island, but the price the Phoenix asked for was too great, and Tirza refused, dooming her people. When Altan returns, Rin apologizes for being unable to call the Phoenix. Altan insults Jiang's cautious instruction. Rin defends Jiang, saying that he wanted to protect her. She asks Altan how, after calling in the Phoenix, he makes it stop. He replies, I don't. Part 2, Chapter 15. After the Sika's attack, Federation delegates approach with a white flag. The warlords argue over what to do, then toss the decision to Altan, who decides they should meet in hope of peace. They meet the delegation, and Rin gets a close look at a Muganese soldier for the first time. She's disappointed to find they look more like Synegardians than Rin and Altan do. The delegation proposes a short ceasefire and a broad chest of sugar and salt as a peace offering. While the militia meets with the delegation in private, Ramsa rushes in, saying the chest of salt is actually saltpeter. Everything explodes. Rin, Altan, and Ramsa survive, but Kertalane is decimated. Rin helps Enki triage civilians for the rest of the day. Part 2, Chapter 16. Hours later, Rin leaves the triage center. Kara won't let Rin see Altan, who is quote-unquote indisposed. Time passes, and the Federation army torments nearby cities, causing an influx of refugees to Kertalane. The populace turns against the militia, and the warlords scapegoat Altan. When Altan reemerges, he acts increasingly reckless and irrational. In Rin's shaman training, the Spearly Woman insists that Rin resist the Phoenix. Rin realizes this is the spirit of Tirza, the last Spearly Queen. Finally, 2,000 reinforcements arrive. Rin recognizes Nija at the front of the ranks. Thank you, Super Summary, for that. And now on to my reaction. Initial thoughts. Those who know me know that I never considered myself religious. My parents both grew up in religious environments. Initially, they tried to give us the same. I don't know the exact reason why they stopped, but I have vague recollections of the conversation. I know that it is cliche, but I can't imagine the alternative. Okay, that's not exactly true. I went to a Catholic high school. The reason was that the school was better than the public schools. I don't want to stray too far into elitist waters, but looking back, Mercyhurst offered me a top-tier education. I can't count the number of times that I realized that over the years and felt lucky. But that's not the point here. Initially, the idea intrigued me. Sure, I violated one of the sacraments by faking communion at my first Mass, but I plead ignorance on that one. I enjoy theology and learning about the stories. Heck, I even asked my parents to let me get confirmed, and a family friend who was a priest helped make that happen. But honestly, I only went through that because I felt ostracized by my peers and thought it might help. It didn't. I went back to my good old anti-religious self. Actually, that's not 100% accurate either. While I agree that religion too often pits us against one another, I don't blame religious people. I blame quote-unquote leaders who use everything at their disposal to divide us. Remember last time when I said billionaires are the enemy? Yeah, let's hold on to that energy. Might be the only thing that saves us. Anyway, back to God. Sort of. I say all the time that I don't even use the word spiritual. It just feels like a non-committal cop-out because our society so deeply intertwined religion and morality. Like you can't live a moral life unless some outside force guides your actions. It's just ridiculous. Okay, final bit of this part of my rant. I'm not sure how to approach this. It may potentially piss some people off. But nobody listens to that, so that's not the main reason. It's just I literally have no idea how to frame what I'm trying to say. Let's start with a story. That usually works. We went to Boston a couple weeks ago. While walking through the North End and looking for a place to eat, we passed a church. Christine likes to walk around churches. For what it's worth, I actually get a bit of a thrill until I realize that much of it exists because of the church, preying on people for donations while enjoying tax-free status in this country. I didn't make it that point this time. I've already made that one several times before. Instead, I focused on someone outside. They were selling religious trinkets, and the booth had a sign along the lines of quote-unquote God is good or some shit. I replied, yeah, God is good except when he looks the other way, when his priests touch little kids. I guess I felt extra spicy that day. But seriously, you can't have it both ways. Benign, all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful deity. Well, he works in mysterious ways. Giving kids cancer and looking the other way as child molestation and rape are committed in your name. Not just in the church, either. The Boy Scouts, famed Christian organization, also stood accused on a wide scale. Mysterious fucking ways indeed. Okay, Sean, you don't believe in a monotheistic deity. You claim that the whole thing is just a way for the powerful men to manipulate things in their favor and deny the divinity of females. Well, I never said that, but you're not wrong. It sums up my thoughts nicely. It does beg the question. Why couch it in that fake challenge from a non-existent audience? Why not just give your opinion? I thought things got stale. I just wanted to shake it up. In either case, it leads to my next point. We always get to there eventually. While I never embraced monotheism, polytheism always interested and fascinated me. I don't know if it's because the concept gives you a choice of deity, that many of them don't feel as demanding as the Catholic God, or I just enjoy the lore of it all. Probably some combination of all three. So when the Sika introduced their gods through their powers and personality, I welcomed the discussion. In fact, I hope for more, but I can talk about that in the quote-unquote what next. I'll give you a hint and say if you're familiar with the Dragonlance saga, I like the way they treat a pantheon of gods. I want to clarify. Even if we lived under polytheism, I wouldn't follow any god unless they prove themselves like they do in the stories. I simply enjoy the history. I like that they have personalities. The Greeks, parenthetically, I told you, middle-aged white guy bias, in parenthetical, brought this human element to the gods. Well, at the very least, I think we figured out the tentative breakdown of the three points discussed earlier. A huge percentage to the story, most of the rest to the good gods, and whatever is left to a choice on the off chance that they give me healing powers or something. Another passage that I highlighted because it stood out to me talked about Nisha and the despair he felt after his injury. Aside from the literal injury, they mentioned the insult of never being a soldier again. This caused him great distress. Those around him wondered how he'd react. Suicide was inferred. Kate wished death upon him. This time he meant it as a mercy because Nisha couldn't live as a quote-unquote cripple. In a few minutes, I'll go into my broader thoughts about war. This specifically interests me because of the reaction of the injury. I never understood those who are so single-minded in general. As a teacher, I struggle with the old quote-unquote teach a lot about a little, or quote-unquote a little about a lot. I often land on the latter. It just feels like you come more prepared that way. See, in either case, you'll end up ill-prepared in certain situations. At least if you know a little about everything, you're not quite as ill-prepared in nearly every situation. When considering something as narrow as mathematics, I think it's along the lines that at least you know where to start. Then who knows? Maybe that triggers something else. It triggers something else, and you at least get closer to the solution. When you expand that to real life, the same may be true. Obviously, that doesn't apply in every situation. Fixing an appliance may require super specific information that you won't just stumble on. Also, some things you need to go under specialized training to do things like rewiring a house, for example. So the approach is not foolproof. However, consider my moniker, Noob of All Trades, comes from the old adage, quote, jack of all trades, master of none, end quote. Like many of these sayings, it has become corrupted. In this case, the master of none is meant as an insult, I suppose. I personally don't find that insulting. I've never dedicated so much time to something to master it. That's an insult? What do they say? 10,000 hours? Spent consecutively without sleep. That comes to about a year and 3 months. Now think about all the free time that you have to dedicate to something. I put aside an hour or two every evening during the week to practice my many hobbies. That's 104 hours a year, give or take. At that pace, it'll take me about 1,000 years to attain mastery. Other than living up to my name and philosophy, if you scale, it gives you some idea of the amount of time you need to devote, even thinking conservatively. Why spend your precious time on just one idea or project? I know it's fiction, but the folly of just such a life is illustrated in the TV show Silicon Valley. The main character follows his dream for 6 years of his life, only to have it repeatedly and then ultimately blow up in his face. Spoiler alert. In addition to being fiction, it doesn't always turn out that way. There's plenty of evidence of people's gambits paying off. It still feels silly to me. It feels especially ridiculous to dedicate that life to being a warrior. Again, more of this to come in a bit. But when your sole purpose becomes an agent of death and destruction, that completely goes against my beliefs. Talk about the nobility of the profession all you want. It just plays like so much window dressing. Wait, Sean, are you saying you don't respect the troops? Of course I do. In so much as that they have a job to do, and most of the time they do it well. But to ascribe them some superhuman or even mythical status is ridiculous. Okay, yeah, dangerous job. I can't deny that. But that's what they signed up for. Isn't that the answer we always get in these situations? In this case, it's literally true. So yeah, I don't get it. Because at the heart of it, it all boils down to my feelings about war. Controversial opinion here, but I just don't like it. In fact, I despise it. On a visceral and fundamental level. Reading this section brought that all to the surface. Christine and I had a conversation about a mutual acquaintance that is suffering. Finally came out in conversation that it all happened due to Agent Orange poisoning. Still we're off from reading the book, I blurted out, war is dumb. She replied, especially that one. No, I doubled down. It's all stupid. Just a dick measuring contest. She countered with World War II. At the time, I couldn't think of a proper retort. Even after doing some research, the only counter argument I found was the isolationist one. That's just weak. So that teaches us about the danger of absolute arguments. There's too often an exception to every rule. But the war in this book? They warned me in the beginning of the summary, but it has it all. First, it's an expansionist territorial war. Of all the things to fight over, land is quite possibly the most ridiculous. We just drove by some houses with massive yards. Like, who wants that? It's just a fucking weed that you have to mow every 2 or 3 weeks. Plus, there were no trees, so you can't even enjoy all that land in the summer. Third, it's flat, so you can't ski or sled in the winter. You, parenthetically, or someone in parenthetical, fought for that? Really? And ever improved it with a gardener or anything? I know I'm saying a lot in this episode, but I just don't get it. Now, Sean, where would you be without the expansionist tendencies of the U.S.? I don't know. However you make the mistake of basing your conclusion only on your assumption that I'd automatically be worse off. We all know about the uncertainty of probability and how changing initial conditions may affect the system as a whole. I refer back to my argument last episode that we probably missed out on many advancements by putting all the resources in the hands of the few. But I digress. Back to the war. Also in the warning, but they discuss the genocide of the Spearley people. Someone who doesn't understand racism on a surface level, I certainly can't make any sense of killing people because of their race. And it happens over and over throughout human history. I would say moving on to more positive subjects. However, still speaking of war, we need to stay in the muck, unfortunately. I promise to try to make up for it with a super positive ending. Remind me when we get there. For now, let's talk about what is callously called, quote-unquote, collateral damage. As I read, I thought about other pop culture media and how they handle the topic. Marvel more or less buries it under the rubble caused by their heroes. Someone wrote an article a few years ago that the people living in the MCU are sociopaths. To live constantly under the pressure that your entire city might be leveled at any moment and not react constantly with abject terror means you can't draw any other conclusion. To their credit, they reckon with some of that in Civil War. On the other hand, the other franchise simply sweeps it under the rug. Okay, that's not true. In the original trilogy, Star Wars treated the death of civilians with all the nuance of a sledgehammer. They blow up an entire planet, probably forget all about it. People are shot with blasters and they just die. Now that I think about it, other than Alderaan, the movie never discusses the ugly side of war, which is completely sanitized out. People talk about the Disneyfication of the franchise. Yes, things are different. And for many, Change means bad, but that's neither here nor there right now. The interesting thing that came out of it is that Finn's story evolves out of a scenario that deals with quote-unquote collateral damage of the war. So in that regard, it finally makes it start to feel more real as an experience. Still not on the level of Saving Private Ryan, or even Good Morning Vietnam, but I give J.J. Abrams credit for exploring that side of the story. On the other hand, in this book, Kwong gives us the ugly underbelly of war. Aside from what I already said, the Poppy War shows how war affects citizens who may have no reason to be included in this war. They lure them in with a promise of truce, then blow them up with that Trojan horse. That's when my opinion started to change. The whole scene shocked me to my core and started that thought process of, quote, horse fucking stupid, end quote, that derailed when presented with a World War II comment. I guess I'll settle on, quote, almost all war is stupid, end quote. Keeping score when we talk about the predictions I made previously. I got a bit ahead of myself with Ren and Nisha. I thought there might be a tense peace for 5 to 10 years, and then the book picks up after that time when the war starts. That's what led me to speculate that either one of them might be emperor and the other is opposition. Instead, Kwong brings the ruckus right away. I also whiffed on the possibility that Ren may be Spearly. Nothing is certain right now, but all the clues were there. I just needed to put together the pieces, and I did not. Additionally, I'm starting to think that my seal of approval is a kiss of death. First, Tudor Feyrick goes back to his small pond. Then, in the opening battle, Zhang disappears. I'm not positive that he's dead. I think that he's either the gatekeeper himself, or he taps into the same god as him. That's my first prediction for this section. And now for the rest of what comes next. Ren again needs to find her place in the Chisika. As of right now, Zhang haunts her and prevents her from releasing her full potential. I still feel that's for the best. Everyone else on the team is fundamentally broken in some way or another because of their bonds with their gods. Altan alone presents as someone who has his shit together. That's why he makes a great leader for these misfits. So at the risk of passing on the kiss of death, I want Altan to help get Ren where she needs to be. I don't think they need to eradicate Zhang's voice completely. Rather, help her to merge the two sides together. Give her the opportunity to control her impulses and the god's influence to rise and face her destiny. Faced with a war and scars from a shared battle, it looks like Ren and Nisha buried the hatchet. And now, against all odds, he's back. They can pick up where they left off. Maybe he can help to release her true self, too. I guess that's one good side effect to war. It forces some people to put aside the petty differences. Then again, it amplifies others in a very distinctive way. So 6 of 1 and a full dozen of another, I guess. Regardless, going forward, I think both Altan and Nisha become confidants for Ren. As for our girl, I think she has one final meltdown. Perhaps she kills one of her own. I'm thinking the water guy is the most likely candidate. Monkey Boy is also a possibility, and the most tragic. When that happens, she needs to focus that power. I'm hoping Jiang comes back in some form, either corporal, or as a vision, or another otherworldly apparition, because she needs to figure it out. If she's going to change the culture, then she can't be randomly exploding and killing people. Now for what I liked least. Not to put too fine a point on it, but I hate war. Look, I get it. I signed up for this. The book is called The Poppy War. So it doesn't come as a surprise, but it does mean I have to enjoy it. To her credit, Kwong spares no expense in her description of the horrors of war. I already talked about some of it earlier, but I bring it up again to reiterate just how much it affected me. It's not unique. I stopped We Were Soldiers and refused to watch it. I still haven't seen it to this day. I did the same with the first episode of season 2 of The Walking Dead. That was because of gratuitous violence. We Were Soldiers was due to the perception of profiting off the horrors of war. I think I first started to feel that way after watching Saving Private Ryan. Everyone talked about how great that movie is, and objectively it is. But when viewed in another lens, it's just the same propaganda being churned out to perpetuate that hero-soldier myth. And We Were Soldiers hammered that home. Everyone talks about how liberal Hollywood is, but like everything else in this stupid society, they just go where the money is. So this means you'll stop reading the book, right? Well, no. First, and least important, I committed to the book for the show. Second, Kwong writes very well. The characters and story are compelling. I genuinely want to know what comes next. Third, she in no way glorifies the concept of war. Yes, she necessarily discusses strategy and other concepts related to war, but she cloaks them in the stench of war well enough that it's not exploitative. Reminds me of how Dragonlance approaches war. What a coincidence! Our next book is the third book in the latest Dragonlance series. Even though they sanitize the concept of war some, but not as much as Marvel or Star Wars, because they'll still give you the dirty side of it as well. I like their approach. Hey, this is supposed to be liked least. I know, but I also promised unrelenting positivity to finish things up. Kwong's depiction of war takes you even deeper in the muck than Dragonlance. Even so, both write well enough that I respect the story, even if I despise the subject matter. And now for what I liked best. I'm a sucker for a ragtag group of misfits that come together to form a team. I love the Guardians of the Galaxy, both the comic originals and the new movie versions. Hell, I also enjoyed the Thunderbolts and even Agents of Hate. Look that one up if you've never seen it before. When I first watched The Umbrella Academy, I effused, they're like a fucked up version of the X-Men. So when Kwong finally introduced the Sika, and instead of highly trained group of skilled assassins, we got this group of losers, it warmed my cockles. As an aside, what the hell are cockles? Now I need to look that up. A medium-sized clam-like shell, rounded and domed with radiating ridges. What the fuck? Slang. The depths of one's emotions or feelings. Again, I say, what the fuck? How did one become the other? Christ, I have some research to do. But not right now. Let's talk about the Sika. I already mentioned two of them. Aracha, who follows a water god, stays in liquid form, and must be carried in a bucket. The Monkey Man, Suni, reminds me of Hulk. As he transforms into a mindless beast, and must be talked down by Altan. Oh, I already talked about Altan, too, as their commander. Another shapeshifter, Yanagin, primarily takes the form of a fox. Ramsa, a pyromaniac, handles blowing shit up. Chagan and Kara are siblings. The former acts as second in command and spends most of the section on recon. The latter is a spy. Enki handles medicine and drugs and must consistently deal with the junkies in town. Baji works with the god of pigs and with Suni forms a two-man wrecking crew. How can you not love that group of psychos? It is just an amazing conglomeration of personalities and powers that shouldn't work together, and yet they do. I'm probably supposed to hate the Vipers, especially given my opposition to that type of BS, but she put together a good team, and they're in good hands. When their former leader ends up dead, Altan takes over. I know nothing about the former guy, but I'm Altan stan, and he guided them to one hell of a victory. Granted, he also allowed the Trojan Horse attack to occur. That just shows that he needs to stay in his lane and watch who he trusts. Yet another reason to hate war. Supposed allies fuck you over for their own gain. But we are again positive. Other than Altan and Rin when she figures things out, who's my favorite misfit? I like the Pirate Kid, but he's a likable character. We only interact with the water guy through the others. Likewise, one of the siblings is gone, and the other plays it too straight so far. Maybe later we get some more of their personality. Enki gives off heroin dealer vibes, and Monkey Man is too predictably unpredictable. So, if you're keeping score, it's the Pig God's Berserker. You know that I don't usually go for the smash first type, and if I do, then it's more the Hulk type that balances brains with brawn. I describe Monkey Man like Hulk, but his alter ego is childlike, not brainy. Something about that is unsettling. I can't quite explain it right now. Additionally, that might sound like I picked him by default. Not so. I just wanted to perform due diligence when selecting my favorite. You know me. I want to ensure a good user experience for my user. I love you, man. On the micro level, their massacre was my favorite part of the section. I know. I just spent the better part of this episode denouncing violence and war. What can I say? I'm a complicated individual with layers. Like an onion. I think during that part, I dissociated from the experience and treated it like a D&D session. All I saw were two berserkers fucking shit up. I own that. But war still sucks. And now for my final thoughts. Other than the subject matter of war continually making me wince and otherwise contort my face into an expression of irritation or disappointment, I enjoyed the section. Kwong brings in new and interesting characters. She masterfully baits and switches to keep you in suspense during the Trojan Horse attack. Her description of the politics and machinations of quote-unquote those in charge also keep us guessing. Who is whom? What is what? And where do we go from here? Plus, her description of the battles, especially the two-man demolition, pleased me so much that I temporarily forgot my protest against war. In the first episode, I told the story of Liam, saying that he heard that it's a good book. I'm glad to announce that that still is true as of this episode. I can't wait to finish this one and then move on to the next two later on in this series. As always, thanks for listening. You can find us if you haven't already at www.twoguysgaming.net. Right now, we just have articles. I wrote an article about my past in tabletop games. Later on in the week, I'm going to write an article about my past in video games. Next week, I'm going to do my present, and then the week after, I'm going to do the future of gaming to celebrate 10 years of the website. After I do this book, I'm going to do the next Dragonlance book, which came in. As I said, I already have my notes for the last two episodes for this one, so those will go up later on this week, probably Thursday and Saturday. and then I can get on to the Dragonlance book. I also updated the schedule in the show notes up through, I think, the middle of next year. Things change, but for right now, I got some pretty good books on that schedule. Check it out. I will be back with this series most likely on Thursday with the next episode. I will talk to you then. Bye, guys. We are